Blog Talk Radio.
Cars in the ditch and five accidents on the way to work.
The pavement may look wet, but ice is wet. So pay attention. And I saw four-wheel drives in ditches.
Well, yeah, if they're anything like here, dude, they are convinced that I'm four-wheel drive, man. I can go anywhere. Here's a thought, Jack Wagons. There's a reason that you see, you know, like ice machines and snow machines that have, like, studs on them. They can bite into the ice. You can have the baddest ass four-wheel drive imaginable. It's not an ice machine. Just a simple observation from a redneck, but, you know, what the hell?
Well, is it in Virginia like it is up in the rest of the South and Mid-South and stuff, to where if you do get snow, pretty much most things shut down?
No. It is totally different here. If it threatens snow, you will see the jurisdictions, you know, the city, the county, and everything. They'll send out crews, and they will literally roll up the sidewalks and everything else.
So they lose their frickin' minds down there, too.
Oh, yeah, they just go flat-ass retarded. They were talking about the cold temperatures that were coming. Schools were closing. I'm like, okay. They threaten snow, all right? If they threaten anything more than a snow flurry, you better go steal a cow, because you're not finding milk in a grocery for any distance. You better go harvest some wheat, some grain, something, and make your own flipping bread, because you're not going to find it in the grocery. These people just lose their ever-loving minds. It cracks me up every single time. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it looks like on Tuesday we'll probably have some possible heavy snow flurries. And you can literally watch the IQ in the atmosphere lower. they just go straight-ass retarded, man. No, he said possibly. But he didn't say snowpocalypse is coming, for shit's sake. You know, you'll see them go through the grocery. They're putting 2 gallons of milk in their cart, 6 loaves of bread. You can't get in the parking lot because everybody's running like their ass is on fire and their heads are catching. But, no, he said it was possible. We may get oh my God, snowpocalypse.
Ah. Okay, so even getting a dusting, by you, the stuff melts and by the afternoon, if it's a nighttime thing.
Typically, yeah. Typically by noon, yeah. Whatever we get is gone if it comes down overnight. I mean, I've seen as much as an inch hit the ground overnight. Wake up in the morning, you got an inch on the ground, it's gone by noon.
Yeah.
Now, however, with this, whatever this weird anomaly was, you know, it's been cold enough that if we actually had snow, it would have stayed. But, yeah, and I will say this, even though it's been, like, you know, damn cold here, I've owned my truck 6 years. It has a block heater that, you know, I plug it into an extension cord. I actually used it, figuring, okay, well, they're saying, like, 30 below or some bullshit with the wind chill and blah, blah, blah. I better cover my ass in case I got to go out. Yeah, well, the second night it actually got to, like, 15 or 20 below. I had forgotten to plug the truck back in. Yeah, it still fired right up. So I'm kind of trying to figure out what the hell the block heater's for.
The Arctic, where the actual temperature is, and that's another thing, too, is wind chill has an effect more on humans than it does on mechanics. Pneumatics and hydraulics do get affected by it, but not usually oil and fuel and all that kind of, like, right now we're on our winter blend up here. So, I mean, that's good to a negative 50 degrees Fahrenheit non-wind chill.
Right.
But before it'll freeze.
Here's the other funny thing. Wind chill. Now, I came from Ohio. I figured out something. I know why we have such big hills and shit here in Virginia, and West Virginia has the mountains. Because God literally took a giant fucking bulldozer and leveled Ohio and shoved all that shit east. That's the flattest place I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's not much better around here either.
But, yeah, wind chill definitely makes it a much bigger difference there. So it was quite interesting.
Yeah, I think Monday was our coldest day. It was a high of negative 15 with the wind chill of, like, I think, 38.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it could always be worse. We don't live in Alaska. Average temperature 50 below or some crap.
Dude, you know what the temperature was? You know what the temperature was in Anchorage on Monday?
Yeah, warmer than Chicago.
Dude, it was warmer than you. It was 52.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah, I was watching, I don't know, one of those shows on TV, like, what was it, Buying Alaska. And I'm like, you know, it shows the people that are walking from, you know, most houses up there don't have indoor plumbing because you're so damn scattered, so. You know, if you have a well and septic system, that's one thing. But most of them have an outhouse. They dig a hole, put this little shack over top of a hole, you shit in the seat, and it goes in the hole. These people are walking, and the snow was chest deep. They have, like, this little path out to the outhouse. And I looked at my wife, and I went, you know, I don't think I'd be eating anything that made me shit. Because I cannot picture the desire to throw on all those clothes, walk through snow to an outhouse to sit where, you know, that little kid that, like, licked a flagpole and his tongue stuck? Yeah, I have no desire to go have my ass cheeks glued to a seat.
that's why most of them are wood, but, hey, no, there is one thing I did have, and just because of family reasons and requests, I'm not going to say names, but do have two close friends that have passed away since the first of the year due to cancer. One was a brain tumor that he had been battling for 22 years, and the other one was a respiratory cancer, which isn't lung cancer. It's different, and I can explain that later. But a respiratory cancer that she had been battling for 37 years. So do have to say rest in peace to the families. I told you I wouldn't mention names. So, but heart goes out to you, and both absolutely amazing giving people.
Yeah, most definitely. Our deepest condolences to the families. But I'll tell you that, what do you say, 22 and 37 years to battle something as unforgiving as cancer that long, I certainly hope that they're at peace and comfortable now. So rest in peace.
Yeah, now, 22 years on a brain tumor. He was 42 years old, and
wow,
the woman who passed away was 59. So most of their child raising lives were spent dealing with this.
I couldn't even imagine. But, you know, it's awesome that they got to spend that much time with their families, even though, you know, they did eventually succumb to the disease. It's great to see them be able to spend that much time. Most people that get diagnosed have so much shorter time to spend. So at least that was a blessing for them. All right. Shall we move onward and upward, my friend?
I think so. We always have to hit a low and give condolences and talk about how absolutely terrible it is outside. And now it creates the up and up.
There we go. And hence, onward and upward. So tonight we have young lady Gwendolyn Devereaux is joining us. And I've got her on the board. I'm going to go ahead and bring her in now, and we'll let her tell us about herself. Hi, Gwen. You in with us, dear?
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, Gwen.
It's going awesome. So, give us a little brief synopsis on you.
Oh, me?
Sure. Well, or you can give a brief synopsis on me. I'm good with that, too. Let's see what the hell you
there
come
you
up
go.
With.
There you go.
I'm fine with that, too.
And I see with
cool.
Matt, all you got to do is throw out just, you know, little one-word adjectives, and you'll, you know, expand beyond his knowledge.
Awesome.
What's an adjective?
What's an adjective? Nice.
Well,
my name's Gwendolyn Devereaux. Go by Gwen. But I am a 31-year-old sufferer of bipolar. I have an extreme case of bipolar type 1 ultra cycling. I didn't find this out until about a year and a month ago, and I struggled with a lot my whole life, and I didn't know it was part of the disorder, especially having it so bad. And the past year, I've been documenting my struggles in creating a successful life with bipolar is the best way to describe it. It runs in my family. My grandmother ended up, she had it pretty much unchecked her whole life. She ended up committing suicide. There's been, like, drug abuse and all sorts of stuff in my family. And so there's not a whole lot of success stories. In fact, it's the opposite in my family. But in finding that I'm bipolar, I also recently found out my oldest daughter is bipolar. She's 9 years old. And so I kind of set on not only documenting my story and setting myself on success, you know, just for my own personal gain, but to give my daughter a success story and, you know, strength that no matter how bad it is, mom's been there and it gets better. So that's kind of, I guess that's the whole point of what I do. I run a blog. I'm kind of in the works, I'm in the beginning works of getting a kind of like a memoir published, my life story, as well as I'm an artist, I'm a painter, which has helped me. I found that out since I found out I was bipolar, and that's helped me out through a lot of the worst of the times. And I guess that's pretty much an overall view of what I do.
I do want to touch base on the art thing that also ties in with the bipolar. I've done a bunch of case studies. I mean, my degree's in psychology, abnormal, and have talked to a bunch of people that have dealt with it. And I don't know if they haven't been diagnosed, but they seem like that they were of a few that I have dated in the past. But this is what I want to clear up, though, is for obviously you go through depressive and you go through manic states. And in being a more of an extreme case, just to kind of give everybody a little bit more of an idea, like what would be an extreme on both ends for you? If you don't mind
an
me
extreme
asking,
what?
You don't. An extreme manic and an extreme depressive.
Okay, yeah, I don't mind at all. In fact, that's one of the things that I want to do is I'm 100% open with all of my disorder because, you know, a lot of people are ashamed or unaware. So, yeah, any and all questions. But to answer that, an extreme level of mania is an absurd amount of self-importance to the point where it's like an overinflated ego. I guess I'll just give an actual example of that. I went to a show, like a concert, and that was a band I liked for like 15 years. And I was there, and I was drinking, ended up going pretty high on the manic scale, like almost instantly. And the singer of said band handed out his set list. And this other, I decided beforehand, I was like, I'm getting that set list, I don't care. And so he handed it to some younger girl. I mean, she had done nothing wrong. He specifically handed it to her. But I decided it was mine, and I went to swipe it out of her hands. And when she didn't let go, it was just this overwhelming, like, how dare you? Don't you know who I am? Or not, you know, kind of that sense of who I am. Or, you know, I felt like almost like this evil queen. And I grabbed her by her throat and just started to squeeze. And I got up, like, made, like, in her face, direct eye contact, and I said, like, let go or I will effing kill you, which is totally against my nature. Like, you know, afterwards, the next morning, you know, I hid for, like, from the world for, like, 5 days. Another, I guess, extreme mania is getting, you know, I used to drink quite a bit, and I was, like, the life of the party. Like, we'd be at a bar, and, you know, things, like the energy in the room would be kind of upbeat and, you know, high energy. And somebody would be like, I would hear someone say like, oh, man, you ever watched this one thing or this chick danced on the bar naked? You know, it was really awesome. And then I took that as a challenge, and I would instantly have no problem stripping almost completely naked and getting up on the bar, like painfully outgoing to the point where, you know, it's kind of a nuisance. Life of the party, everybody loves you, but, you know, the next day, you're sitting there, you know, facing the consequences of you just got mostly naked in front of, you know, thousands of strangers, that kind of thing. I guess that's a better, you know, loss of spending too much money. Like, I would go on these spending sprees. I'd spend thousands of dollars, like, you know, wipe out my life savings in, like, a week. You know, we're talking, like, $10,000, stuff like that. So that's kind of some of the mania. Go ahead.
Well, when you would do these spending sprees, were they just like on frivolous things, or were they like, you know, this would be cool to have, or was it like just a mood thing? It varied from time to time.
It was always something to enhance how scary I looked. Like, I wasn't, you know, like, I had piercings and tattoos, but that wasn't, like, the scary part of it. Is, like, I have shaved eyebrows, and I would put them on, like, a certain angle, and I had all these, like, rings that, like, came to claws at the end, and I had all these other, like, all this, like, stuff with spikes on it. You know, I didn't look like something out of, like, Mad Max necessarily. I definitely looked feminine, but it was just, like I said, it was this obsession with myself, and so it always ended up being clothing, definitely shoes, anything specifically to enhance how scary I looked, which I don't even know what that's all about.
So that was more just to draw attention,
right?
What's that?
And it was
never just to
draw attention?
No, it was never to draw attention. That's the thing with mania is I never needed anybody else's validation for, you know, how great or awesome I was or how I looked. That's the thing is I didn't think there was anything wrong with it, because I never did it for anybody else. And I also didn't care what anybody said about me. I was awesome regardless of whatever I was or wasn't doing, and I didn't need anybody else to feel that way or care. It wasn't for attention. That was just, you know, it was something inside of me. Like, I was stuck inside of my head on who I was, in a sense. Or I can't actually explain it, but, you know, decorating the outside.
Now, what made you choose the dark items, you know, the spikes and the claws and all of that?
Well, I mean, you know, as I get healthier and everything seems to tone itself down in a sense, I'm finding that is, you know, very much what I'm aesthetically drawn to and, you know, how I like to dress myself. But it's a different way now. It's much more genuine. It's, you know, it's not, like, overly done, and it's not for any sort of, like, you know, I guess, you know, to be or look scary or to intimidate people. you know, or get that rise out of people.
It's just what you aesthetically like.
Yeah, it is what I aesthetically like. It's just, it's at a reasonable level at this point. With Mania, it's, you know, it's unreasonable to, you know, just to go to the grocery store to wear a belt that's got, like a bra that's got, like, you know, 1-inch spikes coming off of it and, like, earrings with, you know, all the, it just, it was too much and I was too obsessed with it.
Well, at least at the grocery store, you might have a couple open lanes that weren't open before.
That is another thing that I do like, is I did like, is people did tend to leave me alone. Because I'm naturally a confident person, and then you wear all that stuff, you know, it's like it wasn't compensating for me not being strong or any of that. It was kind of like an overcompensation. I just wanted, like I said, I felt like almost entitled in a way to, you know, if people get out of my way, it's because they should. They should know better not to get in my way. Like, weird thoughts like that.
And I see things like that when we have, you know, I don't know if you caught the very beginning when Matt and I were talking, but, you know, if they mention around here snow flurries or anything, you can't find a gallon of milk or a loaf of bread for three counties because these people lose their flipping minds. Well, see,
yeah,
it would have worked out in your benefit. They'd got the hell out of the way. You could have got bread and milk.
It's pretty much.
I hate to make light of it, but
no,
you know,
no, you're absolutely right. But it was because I think a lot of it is I didn't know how to act in certain situations. Like, I didn't know how to interact with people, and so I kind of just, you know, I overcompensated with, you know, this like way too inflated confidence in the kind of get away from me. But in the, not get away from me as in, like, you know, a closed up kind of shy sense, get away from me as in, like, you know, how dare you talk to me or how dare you get in my way. When at the time I was a bicycle mechanic, like, I didn't have any, like, I wasn't doing anything, and, you know, I had no way to feel that way except, you know, a bunch of chemicals in my brain telling me to.
Oh, I was gonna mention something about that too. You worked at Performance, right?
Yes, I did. I worked there for 3.5 years.
Yeah, I worked at Performance from 16 to 19 here in Illinois.
Oh, cool.
So I saw that. I was like, no way. It was like one of my first jobs.
That was awesome. Yeah, I was an operations manager for 3.5 years. I thoroughly enjoyed the job. I mean, cycling, we can get into that at some other point in time, but, yeah, cycling has been a big part of my life for about 7-8 years now.
All right, and
strangely enough, that was the normal part of me.
But before I bring up the art thing, this there, and you'll appreciate this, I'm trying to paint a picture of the two extremes before I want to talk about the influence on art in earlier pieces versus pieces now.
Mm-hmm.
So on a low point, what happens to you during a low, like a low point?
Depression renders me completely immobile. Like, I have no, the lowest form of depression for me is this overall numbness. It's even past like a sadness. Like, I feel nothing. I am apathetic to every aspect of my entire life. Like, my children, my needing to eat food to survive, me getting up and out of bed. Like, I just, these things don't occur to me as important. Like, I just literally just don't feel at all. And that's when it gets the scariest, because that's when it, out of nowhere, can just kind of turn into, like, it basically can instantly turn to suicide. Like, it's almost, but it's a very apathetic approach to it. It's not, you know, as a lot of other forms, like, it's too overwhelming, or this bad thing happened, or it's like, I don't see any end in sight. Like, when it gets really, really bad, it's just, it's almost like something takes over in my brain, and very non-responsive, unemotional, apathetic, just, like, going to off myself. which I think that's the worst, because, you know, there's no response inside of me to counteract that. That's when it gets the worst.
And how often, when it was at its worst point, I know you said you're getting better now, and that's absolutely awesome, but when it was at your worst point, how frequent were the swings?
Daily. Sometimes it would start in the beginning of the day. You know, I was kind of that unresponsive depression, and then, you know, I had some responsibility to do, and then I would get up, and then I would go have a bunch of energy drinks and then go drinking. You know, I didn't ever get, like, super drunk, but I definitely go drinking and go out, and then almost instead of just feeling better, it would compensate with mania, and then I'd have extreme mania for, like, 2, 3, 4 hours, and then something sometimes would switch my moods at the end of the day, and it was just like a terrible, like overwhelming sadness or a panic attack or something to that extent. But yeah, I can cycle really fast, which is pretty rare how fast I can cycle.
So
it could be.
Well,
go ahead.
You were also having, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you were having a chemically enhanced cycle, to where, like, if you didn't go out and you didn't drink anything or you didn't have caffeine or anything like that, was it as drastic, or was that a facilitator to bring it to an extreme level?
Yeah, alcohol definitely played a big part in it. Like, that could drinking could be a switch. Like, you know, an instant, like, 180. But there were a lot of times that, if you know, there was plenty of nights that I didn't drink, because, like I said, I was a cyclist. I wasn't a complete alcoholic. Like, I had, I was very athletic. I was very fit. So I didn't drink all the time. But when I didn't, I would still gradually, I could switch no problem, which was terrifying. That's probably why I didn't think anything was wrong with drinking. This is all when I was unmedicated. That definitely played a part. Caffeine can cause mania, and then in me, it definitely can cause mania pretty quick. So I think it's kind of a 50-50.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, because some people, it's such a trigger that on either level. And that's one of the scary things about bipolarism with alcohol, is it can trigger an extreme in either direction. Either just
Absolutely.
Let go of all inhibition, or it could plunge you just into, because alcohol is a depressant.
Mm-hmm.
And caffeine being a stimulant,
mm-hmm.
that's what I was wondering, like, and I made a joke one time with one of the professors that I know, and he is also somebody who suffers from bipolar and has, which is what brought him into getting into psychology in the first place. But one of the jokes that I made, I said, and we were talking, like, oh, you want to go, you know, grab a beer or something after work? And he goes, he wasn't a severe case, but he definitely had it. And
mm-hmm.
so I made the joke to him, I'm like, you're not drinking vodka. I'm like, does drinking vodka Red Bull mellow you up then? And he just started laughing. It's like combining extreme caffeine with with high content alcohol, and which makes sense, but it doesn't. It makes sense
yeah.
in joking form, but doesn't in a physical
form. It should be the perfect cocktail.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, about 20, and on a similar note to that, about 20 years ago, before I met my wife, I dated a girl that was just recently, at that time, she had just been diagnosed bipolar. And you mentioned that a form of cycling that I'm not familiar with as far as, how did you refer to your cycling pattern?
Ultra Rapid Cycling.
Oh, okay. Yeah, she was just a quote-unquote rapid cycler. And for lack of a better way to put it, we could go out on the weekends, and on the way, like, to the bar, well, let's see, try to think how I can put this politically correct. On the way to the bar, she wanted to screw my brains out. Once we got to the bar, she wanted to screw everybody's head off and shit down their neck. How's that? It was that instant switch that she was really nice and everything, and then all of a sudden she was just an evil, evil individual.
Oh, yeah.
Is that similar to what you've gone through?
Yeah. I mean, I have those, or I used to. I definitely had that as part of it. I mean, you know, I could definitely be triggered, or, you know, not even triggered. But, yeah, I've gone through similar.
I mean, it was just, I was absolutely baffled. And, of course, at that time I had no inclination whatsoever as to what, you know, bipolarism was all about.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what in the, I mean, it was like day and night in a moment. Like, what in the hell? And then there would be stretches where, you know, 3 days in a row, I don't know, like 3 days in a row, she wouldn't even get out of bed. Like, what the fuck am I missing?
Yeah,
but,
that sounds,
you know, it was really,
I mean, it sounds like it.
To me. But, yeah, I mean, for those that don't understand, you have that, like, okay, we all, I'm sure, have that friend that does that. But, you know, just one moment they're all gregarious and happy-go-lucky, and the next moment they're, you know, hell on wheels. Having dealt with being that side of it, what would you recommend to the friends that are on the outside looking in for them to do?
As far as how I dealt with it, part of it, honestly, up until, you know, once I found out I was bipolar and got medicated, I was pretty 100% dedicated to fixing it. But before that, when I would have those switches, I would, like, I acknowledged these things, and I was like, I wonder why this happened. Like, I was very confused. You know, a lot of times it was out of my control, my behavior's out of my control, but, you know, within moments afterwards, you know, I was very confused, and I thought, honestly, it was a lack of, like, good self-control or lessons I hadn't learned growing up, and so it was like I tried to use everything as an example. Like, I tried really hard, but, you know, these things would still arise. How I dealt with it is I just basically beat myself up on the inside, telling myself that I was acting like a child and that, you know, that's not what people and adults do. So, I mean, honestly, a lot of negative internal dialogue is how I dealt with it, which kind of sucks pretty hard, you know, especially going through it. But, you know, that lowers your overall self-esteem. But I didn't know that it was against my will, and so I tried very hard to teach myself not to do that. So I guess, you know, that kind of exhausted me. But for other people, like, having to deal with that, honestly, I believe most of it lies within the bipolar person. Like, they have to, I mean, you really got to take full control over your, you know, your, I can't say your behavior because that's ridiculous. But, you have to take full control over teaching yourself about the disorder and, you know, your triggers, and then, you know, have other distractions or other plans set up for when these things do happen, and you also have to acknowledge them. As far as, like, friends and family, or, you know, somebody who's, you know, a friend or dealing with this or in the immediate vicinity of one of these switches, I mean, you're kind of, honestly, it differs from each person. But generally, if it's just like a casual outing with your friend, you're kind of SOL, you know, unless that person really knows what to do or how to take care of themselves. I mean, there's not a whole lot the other, you know, another one can do. And that's one of the biggest frustrations for people with this disorder is they want to help. They just don't know how. And sometimes, you know, we can't communicate or we just have not done enough self-exploration in order to communicate what we need in those situations.
Yeah, and that was my biggest problem was I had no idea how to stop her. I mean, literally, I bounced for 15 years, and in 15 years, I probably wasn't in as many bar fights as I dragged her away from becoming a bar fight. Just, all of a sudden, she would lose her flipping mind and just over the dumbest things, and I just didn't understand it. But listening to you and, you know, the way that you explain that self-importance thing, that was a lot of what she did. Like, if she'd be walking through and somebody wouldn't get out of her way, she would literally just shove them across the table if that's what she felt. Like, I deserve to have this path to walk through.
And oh, yeah.
What the hell? And, you know, having the, since she had just been diagnosed with it, of course, you know, they've got her meds all over the flipping place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was hopefully 20 years later they've gotten it to where, you know, they have a really good idea how to start the meds out closer to right.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure that the chemistry in each and every individual changes. But they should have some sort of a, you know, close formula. How fast and how good when you first got diagnosed and they got you on meds, how fast did they start to figure out where you need to be on whatever different meds?
Immediately. I have one of the rarest and most difficult cases in types of bipolar, but I have one of the easiest to manage. Depression is where the medications are kind of all over the place and they don't really, you know, bipolar depression is still pretty much a mystery to the medical community. And being mostly mania, mood stabilizers just basically took off all of that, took off the mania.
But I can
for
also
me, it
cause
was immediate. Pardon?
I say it can also throw you into a deeper depressive state. It's an extremely hard balance, even still.
Yeah, and that was kind of what I was getting at was, you know, how close are they at this point to being able to figure out, okay, from talking to this patient, this is more closely to where we need the meds to be than this, you know?
Yeah, it greatly, greatly, greatly differs person to person, doctor to doctor. Like, I don't think there's any possible way to gauge that. I found out I was bipolar. I was actually at, I found out, and then I ended up at a bipolar institute in Pittsburgh, where I was living at the time, and the institute was great. They monitored your medication, your behavior. I mean, they really thoroughly did the job of figuring out bipolar medication and all of that stuff, more so than I've ever seen or heard of in a lot of other scenarios. My doctor here, you know, is kind of like, he was just like, yeah, you're bipolar, we figured it, blah, 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 here's some, you know, mood stabilizers. And luckily they worked for me, but up in Pittsburgh, like I said, they figured out I was type 1, the ultra rapid cycling, you know, they helped me, cognitive behavioral therapy. So, and then working with other people, honestly, there's no fair way to gauge. I've seen other people the past, like, 5 years, medication still hasn't been right. I know a lot of people that medication hasn't been right for 10, 20 years. They still haven't figured it out. So, I mean, it's honestly, it's just one big guessing game, it looks like.
Now, what is the... In your case, anyway, what is the one thing that helps you most other than the med? Just, like, mellow and, you know, try to stabilize yourself emotionally, mentally, you know, something that you do that helps you the most?
I I say technically it differs, but the number one thing in all of this that has helped me was the, it's called DBT. It's like a, I forgot the actual word, the acronym, but the DBT skills that I learned, it basically teaches you how to control yourself, how to identify, you know, basically figures, if you apply the effort, figures yourself out, and how to manage your bipolar. Now, I have a lot of different specific things that I do depending on what I was going through, but if it wasn't for that, I would have no grip, almost no, you know, 50% or less grip on this disorder than I do now. Like when I took the DBT, which is something, behavioral therapy, I can't remember, but when I took that, it was like a religious experience. Like, I was pretty much sure that that's how people feel when they find God, because it finally explained everything to me, you know, why I was doing these things, and my, you know, after 30 years.
What are my old friends doing?
Hello?
So how was that?
Paul sent me a sound, and I didn't realize that the damn sound was on my laptop, so I apologize for that interruption.
You're fine. But I have to say, that's the number one thing.
Just the DBT, which is...
Let me figure
I'm
out
not sure what it is. I guess I could do a Google and find that. But that seems to be the thing that helped you the most in, like, dealing with what was going on?
Yeah, dialectical behavioral therapy. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like I said, it was almost like a religious experience. Like, it was the answer. That plus medication, or for me personally, that plus medication has been just, at, I mean, like I said, I would not be anywhere close to being able to function daily, you know, or be able to, you know, get through a lot of what's going on still without that. Like, I don't know why they don't stress this more for bipolar patients. You know, a lot of doctors that I've gone to and seen are just like, well, let's try this medication, or let's try that medication. And then, like I said, up in Pittsburgh, they were like, you know, that plus medication monitoring. And even my doctor down here, I was like, hey, I took a, you know, this type of therapy, and it did wonders. He's like, oh, yeah, that stuff is perfect for bipolar people. I was like, I've been going to him for like 4 years for ADHD, and he was the one that diagnosed me bipolar. And six, seven months later, I ended up in Pittsburgh, at the Bipolar Institute. And I'm sitting there, you know, it's like, if it's that perfect, why did you never tell me about it? That's one of the things, like, I try to get out. People are like, what do I do? What have you done? I'm like, go to DBT.
No.
Yeah, that. But real quick, the one thing and talking about your condition versus more of a minor condition, the way is that I've kind of explained it to people in the past that don't understand is it's basically like a traffic light between the red being depression and the green being mania. And it's how long the yellow is basically kind of how you gauge a level, if you will. So
a level, like of
how fast it switches.
Oh, okay.
Oh, so like the happy medium is the yellow.
Yeah, well, that's the transitionary period.
Okay.
Between the two, and yeah, I mean, if you're stable most of the time, but people that have it in a less severe case,
mm-hmm.
is you're basically in the yellow most of the time, and it doesn't mean cautionary. That's not what I'm saying. For people who are actually trying to analyze a traffic light right now and be like, oh, well, you need to slow down because this is what's going to happen. No, it's not like that. Yellow in this circumstance means like normal, if you will.
Between top and bottom is the median.
Exactly. Yes. So yes. Can people run the yellow for a long time? Yeah. in your case, there isn't that much yellow. Or in your previous case, there isn't that much yellow. It'll go from mean to extreme pretty quickly.
Yeah, prior to diagnosis and getting stuff straight. Oh, yeah, I had very little yellow.
Yeah, and that was going to be one of my questions was, in an ultra-rapid cycler, does that mean that you would go from high to low almost instantly at the flip of a switch, or were there, like, precursor signs that those around you could see that it's coming, or was it just all of a sudden you went from, you know, the good witch to the wicked witch?
Both. Sometimes it was a gradual transition, and my fiancé at the time, he, you know, we were together for 4.5 years, he definitely learned the pattern. I mean, we didn't know it was bipolar, we didn't know what it was, you know, he just happened to learn the pattern of what was going on, and he could tell, he's like, I never knew when you were going to switch instantly. He's like, I could never figure that out. He's like, but I could see the precursors of, you know, gradually going one way or the other. So with rapid cycling, I mean, it's, you know, like the rapid cycling or ultra rapid cycling is just kind of represents how many cycles you have a year, or, you know, how the frequency of your cycles, not necessarily, you know, how you switch from one to the other.
Oh, okay. Well, see, that's something that I didn't understand was it referenced how many times you went from, you know, one state to the other. I thought it referenced how fast the transition would occur. So
no, I think
that definitely makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But,
it's defined as having 4 or more episodes of mania or depression in 1 year. And then ultra rapid cycling is, you know, it's much more intense.
Oh, and that means that my friend 20 years ago was probably misdiagnosed, because in the probably 6 months that I was dating her, I'll bet she transferred from one extreme to the next 20 times. And that was after diagnosis and started medicating. But I think a lot of that was the medication.
Yeah, ultra-rapid cycling tend to be a signal that the medication is incorrect. That's generally, you know, that's more so the case than anything else. And so when they, like your doctors notice that you're flipping through these cycles pretty quickly and you're, you know, you're switching, that's a pretty big sign that medication needs to be, you know, reevaluated. But I will also say for females, hormones are a really big trigger for a bipolar. So I will say with females, you know, once our period around that time when the hormones start kicking, can affect us pretty severely. But that's not considered a cycle as much as, you know, that's just being female and bipolar.
Yeah.
The other thing that's kind of that's kind of a sign in somebody who has before I say this, I do want to ask you a question. How long were you having symptoms before you were actually diagnosed? Like, what was the time frame? Was it a prepubescent thing? Was it a pubescent thing up until recently, or did it come on later in life, or?
I'm one of those cases where generally how when it starts showing is kind of, you know, the level of intensity it's going to be. The earliest I can remember was showing signs when I was probably about 7 or 8 years old. I was pretty young, it's not impossible, but it's relatively rare.
Yeah, because it's usually around the pubescent switch is when it really starts rearing its ugly head. I mean, I've seen it in younger kids, but more like 9 through 11.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time it starts like 13, 14, 15, you know, right around that time.
Yeah. There's three triggers that usually, if someone's bipolar, there's three triggers that usually can cause the onset. One of them is stress. Two of them is the second one is hormones, and the third one is lack of sleep. Like, that's pretty much what I've come to understand from doctors and research. So, yeah, so a lot of the adolescence, it definitely kicks in. I didn't know anything was wrong, you know, as I was younger. I didn't know people didn't think or feel like that.
Yeah.
Well, you said your daughter is nine.
What's that?
You say your daughter is nine, right?
Yeah, she's nine. She started showing signs early on.
And like, now most of us just consider that. You know, I don't know any small children that have been diagnosed with it, so I don't know. But I'm going to go out on a limb. I will say my generation, I'm 44 years old. We look at a nine-year-old that is just acting up, and we go, yeah, it's just part of being a nine-year-old. If you have, for all the parents that are listening that have, you know, younger children, what should they look for that's indicative more towards this than just being a nine-year-old and just being, you know, I mean, a lot of them are just kind of assholes at this point in life. What would you suggest they look for more than just blaming it on?
Well, that's the only thing, is it's hard specifically for behavior in children because, you know, like you said, they're still developing, a sense of self. You know, they're still learning, you know, to how to react to, you know, stimuli and social situations. So, you know, it's hard to specifically, you know, trigger or say what. But some of these could be just taken out of context very much, you know, how children react anyway. But one of the biggest things is any disruption in, like, schedule or moving or any sort of disruption like that, like, they're hell for, like, a month. I definitely had that growing up. My oldest daughter, that's one of her biggest ones. A lot of figuring out my oldest daughter was she was diagnosed as ADHD when she was younger, but my ex-husband and I don't believe in medicating children unless it's absolutely necessary, and we were able to hold off that diagnosis and everything until recently, you know, but then her schoolwork became bad enough. But a lot of that is because of me being bipolar and ADHD, and literally looking at her is like watching myself. That's more so how we figured it out more than anything else. And, you know, like I said, a hyperactive child is one thing, but, you know, she definitely showed the extreme signs. So I guess I can't really specifically say, you know, because a lot of what I would say, the way it sounds, is just going to sound like, you know, a child acting like a child. But it's a lot more extreme than that. She's very, very easy to agitate, almost like a teenager. Like, there's, you know, sometimes she's fine and perfect, and then the smallest thing in the world will send her into, like, an inconsolable, like, rage or a fit. But it's not just in the moment. Like, she's going to be off for, like, 5 or 6 days, which, you know, children generally, you know, they're not going to hold a grudge or prolong stuff like that. It will disrupt her whole life for a couple days. And so that's kind of one of the biggest triggers or, you know, symptoms that we noticed.
Well, there's two things over the years, I could call it decades now, that...
Because he's getting old.
Noticed, yeah, I know, right? Shit. But, go on, I'm only a year older than you, so I'm really not that old. And neither are you. Dennis is. But,
correct.
You knew that was coming. But the one thing that I've seen synonymous with bipolar is either ADHD or OCD.
Yep.
So, and those rear their symptoms earlier than what in normal cases. I mean, your case is a little bit different because it's genetic, but and it's predominantly genetic, but in a non-predominant genetic where something will, you know, a disease will skip a generation or whatever, yours seems to be pretty in the forefront. But yeah, that's one thing to where in the scientific community has been very, very talked about is if your child is showing signs of OCD or ADHD, that they also do a bipolar not a screening because there's really no way to do that, but a bipolar diagnosis of a possibility for a future instance now than they did, you know, years ago, like when we were kids.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I do feel there's definitely a connection. My doctor said like 75% of bipolar people are AED or ADHD. But I was definitely diagnosed as ADHD when I was young, like I was like 13, 14.
I think that's one of the things.
What's that?
I said I think we all were though. That was like one of those things, like, oh, yeah, your kid's kind of acting up. No, he's ADD or ADHD. Here's some Ritalin or Cialis.
Yeah, but mine was an extreme case. Like in elementary school, I went from a straight A student. In middle school, you know, once those hormones hit, like I couldn't pay attention to the point where, you know, my grades dropped significantly. It wasn't just a matter, you know, I wanted to pay attention. It just was not something that was going to happen. Like I tried, and I remember going to school and I paying attention, so focused on paying attention that I missed everything in class because I was convincing myself I was going to pay attention. Like that's how bad it was. But like I said, my case of ADHD and all that stuff is significantly more extreme than most people. Like when I would get bored, I ended up in a lot of fights then. I was the weird kid before it was really cool to be the weird kid. I didn't have any other weird kids to be weird with. So I got picked on a lot, but I didn't have a victim mentality. So instead of paying attention in class, I was filing my fingernails to sharp points. So when girls would harass me after class, I would claw their faces open. Like that's, you know, like it was pretty extreme. Yeah, it was, like I said, it was an extreme case and some, you know, I wasn't messing around. Couldn't pay attention, but I also had this brazen, like, defiant type of behavior. Like, instead of paying attention, I would get frustrated and so bored, I would just stand up in the middle of class and walk out, and my teacher's like, what are you doing? I was like, well, I'm done with this because I'm not paying attention. And I'm like, you know, I was like, I don't care what you have to say. And I'd walk out and, you know, go do something else. And they thought when I got tested back then, you know, they did like a intelligence test or an IQ test or all that stuff. And they were like, you know, she's had an above average IQ. So it wasn't a matter of I'm, you know, idiotic. It was like I just could not focus on anything. People would be talking to me and I just would end up somewhere else in my head. I could, you know, people would say something. It's like, what did I just say? I don't know. My reading comprehension I grew up reading on my own. Like, that was kind of my escape, if you will. And when I got into middle school, when my hormones started kicking in, the ADHD got bad, I couldn't read. Like, my reading comprehension, like, I just could not pay attention to the book. And I liked reading. So, you know, it's a matter of, you know, it's definitely overdiagnosed, but there's a lot of times that when it becomes a severe issue, even against my will, you know, things that I do want to be doing, that's, you know, they kind of realize, like, something's really wrong.
And I see, for me, middle school, it was marijuana that made my attention span fall to shit and my grades drop, but that's beside the point.
kind of fall off and then you felt an expression through that and it was something you could focus on more, or was it after everything kind of mellowed out and you got on the correct meds and all that kind of stuff that brought you into art?
Yep, I found out February of last year that I could paint. So, like, what, 11 months ago? I took an art class at the Douglas Education Center. It's the same school, it's outside of Pittsburgh, that has the Tom Savini School for Special Effects.
Okay.
A guy who painted that I grew up, like, absolutely enamored with his paintings, turns out was teaching his class. And, like, I knew who he was, and I was so terrified. You know, my boyfriend at the time was like, you should take this class. And, like, I can't even talk to the guy. But he saw some of my drawings, which were terrible, but he saw that, like, you know, I kind of had the right eye on where I was going. And then I started painting, and it turns out, like, I have that artistic eye. But that definitely took you know, getting the medication straight, because before that, like, the only thing I would do was costuming, you know, for going out at night or just all sorts of weird stuff, but, you know, nothing any sort of, like, fine arts. Like, I did a lot in high school, but I was told by my mother that, you know, there's no money as an artist, you're not going to make anything, you need to become this or that, you know, just not complete, but definitely, like, slight discouragement. So I just kind of gave it up after high school. So outside of that, I hadn't touched anything for, like, 12, 13 years. Which, it's kind of like I found it at the perfect time, because as I found out that I'm bipolar and I'm trying to manage my own mind, and I was also kind of in a bad situation up north relationship-wise, like, I, you know, and I got put on the wrong medication for 3 months. So as all of this turmoil is going on, I found out not only can I paint, but I can also have separate paintings in order to keep myself focused, like, literally just from not acting out, as well as paintings to express, you know, through images what is going on in my mind, because it's, you can't explain this kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and
I don't think words fit. I don't think words fit the description, but I have seen some of the paintings and artwork and such that you have done, you know, off of. Now, go ahead and throw out your page for Mad Bike Woman.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The, all of this I actually document. I have a blog. It's a Diary of a Mad Bike Woman, .blogs.com. And there started March of last year. That's another form that I found to kind of get out a lot of the frustration is my blog about bipolar. It's kind of a lot of the darker parts of it, the depression, the mania. It's definitely the kind of the meat of the, like, the horrible part of the disorder, which can be depressing, you know, and sad to read, but it, a lot of people that have read it, a lot of bipolar people have, you know, come to me, and it's like, I've tried to explain this for years, and you put into words what is going on in my mind. I've showed this to my husband, my wife, my mother, and, you know, it's given them some insight. They understand more now than they ever have, and vice versa. I get people contacting me and be like, look, my husband, wife, or mother is bipolar, and I've never known, you know, what to do or how to help or even what's going on. And I read your blog, and, you know, now I understand a bit more. And, you know, people become more empathetic to bipolar, and they realize, like, even though it's a behavior disorder, like, we don't choose to do these things. You know, and as much as, it, you know, I could or could not have made the choice to punch that person in the face that got in my way, you know, it's hard to understand that that's not a choice necessarily for us. And also, I've had people read it and be like, I've read this, and I, you know, my wife, husband, mother has been basically showing all these same signs, and we went to get them evaluated. Turns out they're bipolar. Turns out they've got PTSD. Turns out they've got BPD. So it's helped, in a, you know, even though it's, like, kind of really sad, and, you know, it definitely pulls people emotionally, you know, it's kind of the part of bipolar that it's hard to put into words. So that's literally my whole, the whole point of it. Also, the point of it is to put all of my dirty laundry out there dealing with the disorder, so people don't feel as alone and isolated, which is a huge, huge problem. Everybody that has bipolar tells me, like, you know, even if they have somebody loving and supporting, dealing with this in your mind makes you feel so alone. Even for me, I mean, it's terribly lonely dealing with this stuff, and it was my entire life dealing with it, and so I put it out there, you know, as a way of saying, like, part of it is because I no longer feel alone because people come to me, but also, you know, putting it out there for other people so they don't feel as alone. And I take a lot of the ridicule and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Or, you know, I've had people harass me online anonymously, directly about, you know, being crazy or just anything they can throw at you that's nasty. But I don't let, you know, it doesn't faze me to begin with, but also I like to show other people that regardless of what anybody says or does, you know, your real struggle is internally, and you need to, you know, forget anybody else that has anything else to say about it.
Well, what kind of, as far as your artwork, like I've seen it, but what kind of medium do you, I know you paint, but what's your typical subject matter of any of the pieces that you do? My mom's an artist. She, even every Thursday, she runs a figure drawing class. She's been an artist ever, like, even before I was born. So that's why I just have the art interest. But I didn't, if you want to explain, like, kind of what your subject matter is of what you enjoy doing.
Yeah, well, two different mediums. My number one is I use acrylics, but the biggest thing with acrylics is I like realism. I like, you know, my paintings to look, I guess, realist, you know, or believable, I guess, as possible. The actual subjects differ. My specialty is fantasy art. Like some of my paintings that I'm working on, I've got like one who's, this devil chick who's like coming out of like, I don't know, some like brick pit or like some dungeon type thing. I've got another one where it's kind of like a tattered Virgin Mary, you know, stuff that I also like to, you know, creatures and monsters and that kind of stuff. A lot of stuff with gas masks is what I really like. So fantasy art, you know, stuff that doesn't exist, but, you know, I like to paint it realistically so it looks like it could exist. That's my one of my types of regular art. For the bipolar art, generally what I do is and it's kind of happened, like I didn't even intentionally mean to, but I paint statues, like Victorian and older cemetery statues. I kind of like a lot of the expression that they have, you know, because it's all about mourning and pain and loss and that kind of stuff, but I think it's so eloquently put, you know, from sculptors a long time ago, and also the weathered look they have, it kind of just almost, it speaks for itself as far as, you know, my mental state a lot of the times, but I like to add more decay or more expression into them. I kind of reshape their stone face a little bit more, I guess, you know, expression of whatever's going on in my mind. So that just kind of manifested itself. I didn't really mean to paint those kind of subjects. I just kind of looked back one day and I was like, okay, looks like this is what I'm painting when I don't feel good. But then I also do pen and ink, and I have a couple of paintings that are a little bit more serious with the bipolar through pen and ink. Kind of the same thing. I realize, you know, I paint figures that do look like, I guess, lifelike cemetery statues, you know, the older style. But, and also to counterbalance that, because I'm not a very depressing or, you know, dreary person to be around. I'm the exact opposite. You know, I'm pretty ridiculous and funny. So to balance all of this, like, seriousness out, I do pretty simple ink and watercolor paintings of various animals wearing fanny packs. So that's pretty much covers all of that.
Now, I want to kind of flip script for a moment, but I understand that you have one other obsession aside from your artwork. We touched base on it during our conversation. No, you put a post last week that actually incited our first talk to be on the show. What was it? Males that have a father issue or something. But you mentioned your serial killers, and I found out that you have an obsession with serial killers.
Yeah, I have. Very much so. I got in trouble. Quick funny story. When I was in fifth grade, everybody was really big into those Goosebumps books, you know, they were kind of like, you know, cute horror books or whatever. And I don't remember how, but I found out about Jack the Ripper. So I'm at the library reading all these books about Jack the Ripper. And it's like, you know, mind you, I'm in fifth grade, this is elementary school. And I thought it was terribly fascinating, not like, oh, man, this is cool. But I was just like, how are you guys reading Goosebumps? Why are we still learning about the Revolutionary War? Has nobody, like, this is terribly fascinating. Why aren't we talking about this? Like, this is, you know, that's what caught my interest. And so in class, you know, when it's a break time or recess or whatever, when we have time to read freely, I'm reading these books from the public library about Jack the Ripper. And my teacher noticed, and I got sent to the principal's office because that was inappropriate, and I had a psychological evaluation because I don't even know how old I was, and I'm reading nothing but, you know, these huge books about Jack the Ripper. And so that's kind of where it started, but I got my first psych evaluation from that.
Oh, shit. Yeah, that's not exactly where you want to get a psych eval. Well, let's see, what kind of reading do you do? Oh, you know, Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, my mom thought I was, like,
Green River
mostly growing up that I was, she thought I was going to be a serial killer. She told me that a couple of years ago. She's like, I was pretty sure that's where you were going.
Well, here's my question about that. If you're going to get in trouble and get sent to the principal's office, what dumbass put the book in the library in the first place?
Well, I went to the public library, not the school library.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant the school library. I'm like,
no.
Yeah, if you're going to get sent to the principal's office, don't put the book in there in the first place.
No. I don't remember how I found out, but I remember I went to the school library, and, of course, they had nothing about it. You know, I went to the public library and, you know, found tons of books about it, and I thought I'd hit the – like, that was what was interesting to me. You know, I didn't care about, you know, freaking Revolutionary War and that crap in school or, you know, learning about pilgrims and making, you know, hand turkeys. I didn't care about that shit.
There we go. So who is your biggest of interest – serial killer? If you were to read a book about any one specific serial killer, who would you want to read about most?
I have two. One of them, Albert Fish. I think Albert Fish is just terribly fascinating. But my favorite of all time has to be H.H. Holmes.
Ding, ding, ding.
Now,
that's being in Chicago. I've been working with this for a long time now, and haven't even close to scratching the surface of a lot of my friends around here and throughout the country that this is what they do.
Now, why is H.H. Holmes the one that fascinates you most? What is there about him? I mean, you have people like Jack the Ripper that have such a notoriety. I mean, he's, you know, early 1900s, actually pre-1900s. Well, of course, so was H.H. Holmes, but he's not known to be globally for the most part. Why is H.H. Holmes the one that fascinates you the most?
All right, well, let me put something out there first. Is I have fascination with serial killers and all of that kind of weird stuff, but I don't enjoy human suffering or death. But a lot of things I'm going to say, it could be taken weird, So with that being, like, none of this is cool because any of them were killing people or people suffered. It's just I'm fascinated by weird things.
The psychosis
I'd say,
of the mind of these individuals is what draws you to learn about them. Is
yeah.
that a good
assessment?
Okay.
I'd have to say, also, first thing is, like, you know, Jack the Ripper. I mean, I was into him when I was younger, but as I learned about more and more killers, he's kind of like Charles Manson to me. It's just, it's been overly romanticized, and I don't know why society's latched onto them versus, you know, a lot of these others. But I guess a lot of the other ones are pretty awful, so you don't really, you know, you don't want to see that kind of stuff on the news. But H.H. Holmes, part of it is he was incredibly intelligent. He was, you know, he actually finished college, which apparently a lot of, you know, serial killers, kind of the MO is, you know, they don't finish school, they become disgruntled or withdrawn or any of that kind of stuff. But he was incredibly intelligent to the point where, I mean, he built a whole freaking mansion in, you know, as basically some sort of, like, death, you know, murder castle. I think that's what they, yeah, what they call it, like, murder castle or whatever it is. But
that was the name of it.
Yeah, and he, you know, in fact, you know, cycled through the workers so fat, you know, so much that, you know, nobody actually knew the actual plans of it. He was doing all of this right under people's noses, and, you know, and it's just, and he was smart enough to do it, and he got away with it for so long. I mean, it wasn't, you know, not all of them were, you know, infallible, but, you know, he just, it blows my mind how intelligent he was. And he had, like, these chutes for the bodies. He'd go to the basement. He had, what is it called? I don't know why I'm having a brain fart. But crematorium, you know, blast, you know, he's killing, you know, a bunch of people, you know. So he's got to have, you know, burning bodies pretty, you know, I guess regularly enough in this crowded area of the city. And he's selling the skeleton, you know, the medical, the skeletons as medical skeletons to, like, you know, the universities around him. Just if anybody had taken a moment to look, they'd be like, oh, I don't know about this, this guy. Something might be going on. You know, nobody did that. Eventually he got, like, really brazen and, you know, kind of slipped up enough. But for so long, it just, it blows my mind because not only is he that intelligent and that successful, but he is, when he built that new, you know, that new house of his, the whole purpose behind it was to kill people. Like, what part of the human mind does that drive, especially an intelligent one? Like, where is that connection? Kind of like bipolar people, a lot of them are creative. You know, there's a lot of bipolar people as artists, as writers, musicians, you name it. And then you have this guy, like, what was that? I guess that's what fascinates me the most by him.
Yeah, well, I have a special gift for you, Glenn. I have a gentleman on the line named Dane Ladwig that once you got into H.H. Holmes and your knowledge of him, Dane has written a fabulous book on him. And
really?
Dane, are you with us?
I am. How you doing, Dennis? Matt? Gwen, how are you?
How's it going,
fantastic,
brother? How you been?
I've been doing good. How about you?
I'm doing all right. I haven't talked to you, man. Happy New Year. Shit. I know it's eight days into it, but still.
And the last time I was on your show, the phones crashed many times, so hopefully we can make it through this time.
Yeah,
well,
hopefully.
Now, Dane, would you care to share with Gwen what your latest book is?
Well, it's titled Dr. H.H. Holmes and the Whitechapel Ripper. And basically it draws a correlation between Jack the Ripper and Dr. Holmes. And I go into basically Holmes' visits to London and how he fits the eyewitness reports and the Stockholm evidence of who Jack the Ripper was. And to touch a little bit on what Gwendolyn was talking about as far as what keeps people 125 years later interested in the Ripper and in Holmes. I think with the Ripper, it was not only the mystique, but, you know, just the fact that this entity with no identity held the world at bay for 125 years. That's why people just keep going back to the Ripper. He was able to commit these murders in London, and he was given this name. He didn't take this name on himself, Jack the Ripper. It was given to him. And go through the next century and a quarter and remained at bay. Then you have Dr. Holmes from Chicago. Actually, before that, he was in New Hampshire. He grew up in New Hampshire, Gilmanton, New Hampshire. And he went to medical school, University of Michigan Medical University, and he received his degree there. And actually, he began, while he was at University of Michigan, that's where he learned and honed his skills to articulate skeletons. For those who are unfamiliar with it, that's basically removing all of the tissue, the organs, everything from a human corpse, and putting the bones together and making a skeleton on a stand that stands up like you would see at a doctor's office or something like that, that would use in medical schools, et cetera. That's where he honed his skills doing that. And he was an expert at articulating skeletons. So much so that he and his college classmate, who was from London, articulated skeletons and disfigured bodies and decided that they were going to defraud insurance companies, and they used bodies from the college morgue to disfigure them and file fraudulent claims and get away with it. That's when he started becoming the big scammer. Now, what's going to surprise people in the book is they're going to find out why Holmes became a scammer, why he became a murderer, why he held numerous residences in the Chicago area, built a murder castle, as Gwendolyn was telling you, that had a basement which had a laboratory in it. It had a furnace for incinerating bodies in it. It had lime pits in it. It even had a stretching machine to stretch the human body and cause torture.
Do you have a specific name for that? What was that?
What was what? The machine?
Yeah, I think he had like his own name or something for it. I don't remember. Maybe not.
Hell?
No, I think that's what the victims called it. But I do have...
Yes.
Let's put it this way.
It was known that he would prolong his victim's death as long as possible to see how long they could go on. You know, he was playing God at the time. See how long they could go before they would depart and cause as much torture as possible.
Just a sadistic.
His stretching machine, what he was using the stretching machine for, is there was a theory that, and he even discussed it allegedly at one point, he discussed the fact that he wanted to create this Aryan gigantic minions of people by stretching them and seeing if he could create people taller than the normal person. 9-foot people and have them all under his realm, under his power, his authority.
Sounds like Mania.
Yeah, just bizarre.
Now, with
but
your fascination, oh, I'm sorry, Dane.
No, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I appreciate it, brother. Now, Gwen, with your fascination with H.H. Holmes, I'm sure with all the reading that you've done, there's got to be one question about him or, you know, something in his realm that you've always wondered. Now, I'll tell you, Dane has done a shit ton of investigation and back work and everything else. That one question that has just burned in the back of your mind for the longest time, what is it?
Well, one of my fascinations with H.H. Holmes is the fact that none, to my knowledge, you know, limited, none of his, I guess this might be my question, his murders seem to be for sexual gratification, which generally seems to be, you know, a driving reason for a lot of the other serial killers that I do enjoy. Was his any way driven by that, or is it, you know, like you said, he's a scammer. A lot of it, you know, he just had no, you know, a complete disregard for human life is, you know, just driven by, what is it? Driven by, you know, by, I can't even think of the word right now. But, you know,
just
for personal
torturous
gain.
Torturous control?
Yeah, torturous control, personal gain financially, you know, it seems to be very, I guess, arrogant in nature. He wanted to see if he can make these taller minions. You know, I'm sure he's torturing people, no reaction, you know. Not sure if he gets from, like I said, I've read any satisfaction from, you know, the torture and murder of these people. It just seems to be some sort of other interest. Like you said, eventually stretching him out to see, like, if he could create this other taller race or, you know, a form of human. It just seems, like I said, bizarre that it's kind of emotionless, which is neat.
Well,
but is that true?
Yes. In answer to your question, I not only wrote about Jack the Ripper and Holmes, I also write books on serial killers. And I've authored one, and I'm working on two others now. Serial killers kill for various motives. As you pointed out, one is for sexual gratification, and others include financial gain, power, and I can tell you with Holmes, his was greed. Mm-hmm. That was his pure motivation, was greed. He was totally motivated for wanting to have, to own, to gain other people's finances, wealth, and any and all property they may have owned. He would marry, and many of his relationships consisted of getting involved with someone who came from a wealthy family.
Mm-hmm.
Was that his initial trigger? No, it wasn't, and it will be coming out in my book. I won't give too much away here, but just enough to let you know where I'm coming from on this. His initial trigger, which he carried with him throughout his entire short life. He died in his early 30s. You know, there are pictures depicting him as an old, raggedy old man going to the gallows, and that was just not true. He was motivated to avenge a family degradation. And that was set from when he was a boy. Not from his own degradation, like some have thought, but from a family degradation that began when he was a boy, and he carried it through with him when he was in college as a young man. He said, I will, if for nothing else, the rest of my life, devote every ounce of my being to getting back at society, the human race, by extinguishing it. And he succeeded as best he could in the best way he could, and he was very successful because the man was super intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
Had he used his expertise for other than ill-gotten gains and murder, this man could have been the president of the United States.
I think that's what fascinates me the most, is there isn't a whole lot of instant gratification or like a primal need in a sense. You know, he kind of set his mind to it, and I think that's one of the reasons he became so successful, is there was that, I guess, in my, you know, from my observation, like that detachment as far as just needing to kill that moment. And that just blows my mind. I love it.
Right, but then with that, I do have to add, he could have became a president of the United States, but then again, Hitler was the leader of Germany, too. You know.
Well, yeah, and there is that mental disconnect that you can actually correlate between the two of them, even though they, you know, had totally different methods in what they were doing. You can find that mental disconnect similarity between them, because there was that kind of God complex that both of them were striving to achieve. Now, Gwen.
Yes, I don't know if it's, you know, I have to correct you. A lot of people will just box it up into a God complex. What I would like to say is that they had a separation from humanity. At some
mm-hmm.
point in their mind, in their mentality, and in their character, they separated from humanity. It's not so much a God complex as it is separating from humanity and setting themselves aside from humanity.
I find that fascinating, because for me that sounds like it just kind of goes against everything we're, you know, built as a species to be highly social and, you know, kind of that kind of I guess, natural existence. So that, I think that's what definitely drives me, is like just for that disconnect to happen. I don't know if it's choice or born that way, but it's a better way to put it than the God complex.
Well,
and
Glenn, in the same respect, though, Dane did have a actual meet and greet and face to face with a current serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also going to be more information in the book as well, which will tie everything in. But it's kind of a modern day meets past to develop a hypothesis, if not proof of fact.
Now that brings up another thought. Gwen, if you had the ability to meet with any modern day living serial killer, who would you want to meet with? And, you know, if all questions were on the table, nothing's off limits, what would you ask them?
I don't think I know any current living serial killers.
You got Manson.
I don't really care for Manson.
Well, Manson wasn't a serial killer, though. He was more of a cult leader that...
Yeah, he was a cult leader.
Yeah. He didn't actually... You know, there are no proven instances where Manson himself, with his own hands or tools, took a life. He just happened to manipulate people into doing it for him. In order... Now, see, I don't even consider Manson a serial killer. In order to be a serial killer, you actually have to be the one taking the lives.
Yeah. I don't know, Manson just doesn't interest me kind of at all. I mean, also I got obsessed with, you know, the concept of cult leaders once upon a time, and so by the time, you know, like, you know, Manson just seems to be the one that everybody's focused on because of the whole involvement, but as far as that concept goes, Manson doesn't excite me as a cult leader, or, you know, if you want to call him a serial killer or a murderer or whatever.
Yeah. I just want to call him a nutcase that happened to have idiots that were dumb enough to follow him.
Oh, yeah.
And he still does.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, exactly.
Dane, as far as what you've come across with past, is there past serial killers with all the research you've done, because it's not just on Holmes, but do you see any correlation with what current activities are with anybody, or no?
Well, there are a lot. The experts have come up with an entire list, and you can basically fit just about every serial killer in the top 20 list. But then again, I do want to preface it with saying you could probably take 80 out of 100 people who are not serial killers and fit them in that same list. Bedwetters, okay? I was a bedwetter when I was a child, okay? But I'm not going around killing Alice living down the street, okay? People who do not do well when they're in school as a child. People who commit devious acts on animals, okay? I've seen little boys sit there and take and drag dogs, but they're not, they grow up, and I've seen them. They've grown up in my neighborhood, and they don't go around killing people. So there are the list of the things you can stereotype them with, and they'll fit that. But then you have a list where the people like Holmes, they just don't fit that list.
No, smart or intelligent, articulate, upstanding members of the community. Well,
exactly.
In a way.
Look at
member,
look at John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne Gacy owned his own business. He had a nice house that he kept up. He was not any issue with any of his neighbors. He actually went and he drank at the bars where the police hung out. He stayed friends with some of the police. And he knew
Great.
They were following him. Okay?
Well, you just named 4 points of my life. Now you're starting to scare the hell out of me, Dane. Thanks.
Is there a single trait? No, there isn't. Well, at the same time, you also have to there's a differentiating personal trait, and you're right, to where it's not somebody like the Zodiac Killer who writes basically a novel to the LA Times to try and be found out.
Right.
So it's a completely different psychosis. Versus somebody who's trying to stay in the shadows and does it for maybe reasons that they have absolutely no idea and don't understand why they're doing these things, but there's the morality issue that basically just stabs at them after they do something, which Jeffrey Dahmer had that. I mean, he had morality issues.
Yes and no. I have to disagree with you. He did not have those morality issues until after he was arrested.
Exactly.
Had he had those morality issues, he would have walked into the police station prior to killing all those individuals, chopping them up and putting them in his refrigerator.
And acid vats and the... Yeah, it was an apartment-style Holmes, but he wasn't doing it for profiteering or selling anything. But Dane, you and I have had this conversation for a long time, is human mortality didn't have the same respect that it does nowadays. I mean, there was still... gunfights, there was still all that stuff in the mid to late 1900s into the 1800s into the early 19th century.
Well, yes and no. I mean, back then Yeah, back then you didn't have gangbangers walking up and down the street with Tech Nines, and they didn't have to lock their doors.
Yeah. But I'm saying if there was out west a little bit, if there was a duel, you know, or somebody was shot in the street, there wasn't it wasn't the repercussion that it is now.
No, it was, you know,
correct.
Bob and John had a fight. John got stupid. Bob killed him, and, well, John should have been faster on the damn draw. Now you got all of...
To a degree.
Yeah,
to a degree.
You,
do have some back then. You have the Bloody Benders, who I wrote about in my last book, Serial Killers Anthology. And, you know, back then, the Bloody Benders, it was a big thing. And I have some pictures, never before released pictures, in my book, in my chapter on the Bloody Benders. And this, the family, which I had a hard time fathoming, how can a family turn serial killer back in the Old West? And they did.
Are you familiar with that one, Gwen?
Which one is that?
The Bloody Benders.
I don't think so. Maybe. I don't know.
Oh, that one's actually an amazing story. That it was a family who would take in a transient or something like that, and they had a very I'm going to put this just very easy in general. They had pretty much a hot daughter who would entertain him, and then either the father or the brother would come up behind him with a hammer and slap him in the head or some other kind of device and basically kill this person for no reason.
What was this family called?
Benders.
Yeah, it was the Bender family.
B-E-R-S.
That's in a nutshell. Dane has a shit ton more information about it.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever actually heard of them.
Dane, was that an easy and quick synopsis?
Yeah.
Yes or no?
I looked it up on Wikipedia real quick.
Yeah.
Well, no, don't go Wikipedia. That's all lies.
Well, just enough to figure out if I knew him or not.
Yeah.
But,
well, what was
the look up, Dane?
What was the no that I missed in that quick synopsis, Dane?
Oh, that synopsis. Well, there's a whole lot there, but I'm not going to get that much into it. Basically, they bought property in Kansas, Labette County, Kansas, and they were one of the first settlers there. And it was on the main road going in and out of that area. And people traveling through, Pop Benders decided, well, you know, we can make some money here. Let's open up an inn. So they took half of the house, they made it into an inn, would stop on their travels through, and they could buy supplies or get a meal or even take in a room for the night. So people stopped, have a meal. They would join the Benders at their dinner table, and Kate Bender, the daughter, would... She was known as a person of superstition, is what they called her. But basically, she was into the dark arts. She would start talking to people about it, the travelers, and while she was discussing it with them and mesmerizing them with her tales, usually it would be her brother would come up behind the individual and smack him in the head with a hammer. Then there was a trap door in the floor underneath the chair, and they would open the trap door. The individual would fall down in there, and 9 out of 10 times they would still be alive while they were down in there. They would wait until they either hear him stop flopping around and pass out, go down in there and beat him until they died, and torture him. And then take all their clothes, all their personal belongings, their horse that they came up on or wagon, and then bury them in the yard. When they were finally caught, they weren't caught, but the town kind of figured out that everybody had to go past their place in order to get in and out of town, and that's where the last place they were seen. When the town decided they wanted to go and investigate. They went there. The benders were gone. All the supplies were gone. Everything was gone. But their horses were still there. Animals were still there. They were all very malnourished and so on. And they started putting two and two together. They smelled a stench. They went underneath the house. They actually took the men from the town, picked this house up and moved it. Went underneath because they saw blood and everything. They went underneath in the dugout cellar where the people would be, and they found bones and so on. Then they figured, okay, well, I think we better start digging the place up. They went around and they dug all kinds of graves because that's where the people were, and they dug up all these people that the benders had killed. Some were buried alive. They found a little baby on top of her father, and the baby was buried alive. This was something in that time that was just unheard of. It just swept through not only the U.S., and this is, mind you, this is the mid-1800s, not only the U.S., but through Europe. I mean, it was just, it stymied the entire globe, the bloody benders, an entire family that went rogue, went serial killer. They got away.
Last stuff I heard is that they were rumored to have gone to Texas. There's a bunch of different ones. Also, in the, I think it's the Kansas City Museum, I want to say, is there's a knife, more like a kitchen knife, that they used to slit the throats of their victims.
Historical Society.
Yeah, that's, I couldn't remember the city or what museum it was in, but yeah, no, that, it's an interesting, well, it's interesting, but it's sad at the same time.
Now, I know you only have a few minutes left, but I want to leave you with this on H.H. Holmes and Jack the Ripper. Many people that know H.H. Holmes, and this, I want to throw this out there for Gwen so that she has something to think about, made the murder castle. He designed it.
Mm-hmm.
He continually fired the people who were building the castle in order to keep it secretive. He also had purchased many different businesses. It's all in my book. He had a glass factory, the ABC Copier Company, and others. He owned homes. He had a house in Wilmette. He had one in Toronto. He had one in St. Louis. He had houses everywhere. This is going public for the first time on your show, Matt.
Yeah, I know. Thank you. We talked about this.
Now, Dr. H.H. Holmes, fitting with his character and fitting with his business that he conducted here in his residences, a lot of people are not familiar with, which they will be familiar with once my book is released in 3 weeks. He had two residences in London, one in Whitechapel.
Hmm. And did I hear you say Toronto also?
Oh, yes. There was a cab driver murdered in Toronto when Holmes was traveling there.
Are we, and I might be getting into something I maybe need to shut the hell up about, but are we getting into a potential that H.H. also had continued his spree perhaps in Toronto?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Hey, Gwen, this might also be something we're designating time just for this with maybe possibly special guest. Dane, we haven't talked about that, but Are we still on for the 29th? About the...
Yeah.
So, Dane, you there?
You there?
No. Oh.
Hello. Yeah, no, we're still on.
But no, is Dane gone?
No, I'm here, but you keep popping in and out.
Oh, sorry about that. We still on for the 29th?
We are.
All right, with and any word on the special guest? And I'm not going to say names, but any word on the special guest yet or no?
Not yet.
Okay. But no, there's going to be a whole bunch of new stuff. Gwen, I'd love to have you check that show out. And normally I don't book out too far, like a week or so, but no, anytime that Dane's on, we definitely have to have a book out, especially, or not a book, physical reading book, a booking for us.
We have a pre-scheduled show. We very
yes, there you go.
Jesus. Don't get so damn technical, dude. Normally, we don't pre-schedule. Gwen, just like you got this afternoon, I shot you a message and went, hey, you up for being on the show tonight? Shit. Yeah? Okay. Yeah. So, by the way, welcome to Full Spectrum Radio. This is, I am the bus driver. I am notorious for chucking people under the bus, be it guests when I call them at last minute, or sometimes Matt drives that bus, or when I chuck Matt's ass under the bus. But
which
I'm
used to the underside
very frequently. Yeah. Now I'm going to make this real fast. We have like 2 minutes left. Gwen, do me a favor, darling. Throw out your plugs as far as where they can find you. You know, the blog that you have, Facebook. You know, things like that. And that way those that are trying to figure out bipolarism and so forth and those around them that may have it, they can learn from what you've already been through, which is a absolutely amazing story. And I am so thrilled and thankful that you joined us tonight just to share what you've been through. It's an amazing story.
Well, thank you. And my blog is... you can find it on Facebook, too, and actually, if you just put it in search, it comes up. It's the only thing like it is a Diary of a Mad Bike Woman, so as in bicycle. And you can find my blog, the Facebook page. You can even find me on Facebook. I don't even mind with that, Gwendolyn Devereaux. But, I mean, check out the blog. It's, like you said, it's probably the biggest resource for personal experience as far as, you know, bipolar, one of them. And thanks for having me on.
We definitely enjoy it, but don't go anywhere. Even though we're going to go off air in a little bit, we will still continue this conversation because I got a few more questions for you. Dane, do me a favor, my brother. Throw out your plugs.
All right. You can get any of my books on Amazon.com. Just throw my name in there, Dane, D-A-N-E, Ladwig, L-A-D-W-I-G, and all my books will pop up on there. You want to see anything more about Dr. A.J. Holmes and Whitechapel Ripper, just go to HolmesTheRipper.com. And I look forward to being on with you guys again on the 29th, is it?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
The 29th.
Awesome. All right. Thank you, everybody. Have a good night. We got about 5 seconds left, so I just thank you, Gwen. Thank you, Dane. Thank you, everybody who listened, and love you, and we'll catch you next Wednesday.
Thank you, everybody. Now, Gwen, I know, Dane, we've gone into archive, but I got to tell you, between the two of you, that was fantastic. Thank you both so much for taking time to hang out with us and just talk about the mental disconnects that happen in humans, period, be it from the serial killers or, you know, the I get I'm not real sure what the hell you would call it as far as the, like, bipolar aspect. It's a chemical imbalance that causes kind of a, well, that's pretty much what it is, right?
Yeah, it's a chemical imbalance that generally affects people's behavior and more so, you know, how they process the world and the information around them. And it greatly affects people's interpersonal, interpersonal relationships. Excuse me.
So, and, well, Gwen, real quick, and Dane, you might be interested in this, and Gwen, in your research that you've done as far as serial killers versus bipolar, not saying that anybody bipolar is a serial killer, but have you found any correlation between the two at all?
No. There's a lot of bipolar people that have committed atrocious crimes and, you know, have involved murder. But a lot of them, surprisingly, really don't involve bipolar. I can't say 100%, but just, you know, because my memory fails me. But that's one thing I did notice, you know, I would definitely take, you know, pretty big note of. But not really. But there's a couple other disorders, but that one's actually not in there. It's because we have short attention spans.
Well, that's kind of what I was wondering. Is like, I mean, yeah, if you get into sexual identity and all that other stuff that are facilitators of of serial killers, but I didn't know, and I've never noticed anything this far, and unless somebody is in not a bipolar, but a complete manic state, like when you said that you were choking somebody to get the playlist, that would even kind of resemble that.
Yeah, but that wouldn't contemplate me, you know, like I said, there's plenty of bipolar people that, you know, go over the edge, but a serial killer, like, an, you know, killing people over a certain amount of time with downtimes in between, generally not a bipolar thing.
Yeah.
Or, you know, yeah, mania, definitely, but bad things can happen.
I never looked into that before, and I didn't know if you have, so.
Yeah. Like I said, there didn't really seem to be, I mean, there's some, like I said, not a significant, like, amount or, what's the word, connection. A lot of BPD, which acts like bipolar. But bipolar is caused from a chemical imbalance. BPD, borderline personality disorder, is caused through, it's basically like bad behavioral type. It mimics bipolar, but it's usually from like a really bad upbringing or some sort of traumatic childhood or adolescent event or situation.
Yeah, well, it's there's a lot of ties to a neurological disorder also. Spinal meningitis actually has been misdiagnosed as a facilitator for serial killers.
Really? That's actually kind of crazy to hear.
Yeah. Well,
now
we're also talking about turn of the century medicine.
So, true.
1920s, 30s, all that stuff, like more around the 1900s when, because that's when medical conditions really came to the forefront.
Yeah, but I don't think it really counts. I mean, back then, also diabetes was a mental health issue versus, you know, just being a medical one like it is today.
Yeah.
Now, that brings up another question that, and I'm not real sure how long Blog Talk is going to let us carry this on. It kind of screwed us Monday night. Usually we have 1 hour after showtime before it throws us out. But, Dane, given the extensive, what did that word come from? extinction. I got my tongue over my eye teeth and can't see what the hell I'm saying. Given the extensive research that you have done regarding so many different serial killers, have you noticed a predisposition in their past prior to them becoming what they became as to having been diagnosed or anything with some sort of a mental disorder? Like, you know, we say little Johnny down the street has, you know, I think he's a little jacked up, man. Kid down there torturing cats. Does shit like that show up in the history of, you know, like H.H. or the Green River or anything like that?
What I see is there's a buildup, like a condensation of issues that bring an individual to a certain point where psychologically something breaks, something happens, there's a change, a morphing, if you will, and they reach a point where they go over the edge, and even if they know that they're going over the edge, they don't stop themselves, they can't stop themselves, or they won't stop themselves, and they don't have the willpower to want to come back from going over that edge. The ones that do are the ones that walk into the police station and give themselves up. Is that a mental disorder, psychological disorder, emotional disorder, physiological? It's hard to say because there's just not enough data on it over the years. Unfortunately, what we do as a society is we tag these people as being abnormal. They're guilty. The jury has found them guilty. We throw them behind bars. We pay, depending on where they're at, between $18,000 and $45,000 a year to incarcerate them until they die or until they go to the death penalty, which many states are not doing that anymore. And unfortunately, we're not investing the time, the money, or the interest in wanting to find out why that is, why they reach that point and don't come back. You know, talking about bipolar disorders, you know, it's a condition. What I've been listening to is there are periods of depression, periods of being very happy, and then being very irritable and agitated. And I have to say, you know, that there are extreme cases, I understand, but to some degree I believe everyone has those conditions. There's nobody exonerated from those conditions. Some have more extreme, and some people just cope with them on a very different level.
Bipolar is involuntary, though. That's the difference.
Right. But, you know, that's the argument that the criminal is making, is especially the serial killer, is that it's involuntary. And I'm not saying that they're connected in any way, the bipolar or the serial killer. What I'm saying is that what I see as being very unjust in our system, we're not investing the proper resources into finding out why it's involuntary with these criminals.
Now, Gwen, I'm not sure about the list of serial killers that you've developed such an interest in, but Have you noticed any similarities amongst all of them? And, well, I won't say against yourself because we're not, you know, singling bipolarism towards being serial killer, don't get me wrong. But have you noticed any similarities between the ones that you've read, one to the next, in, like, their upbringing or anything like that?
I think it goes, I mean, yes and no, because, I mean, you know, there is such a incredibly large range, but I definitely like the ones that, you know, as far as, not necessarily have, like, a traumatic childhood, or, you know, like, they weren't necessarily, like, abused or beaten, but they have some sort of weird psychological issue, kind of like Ed Gein and his mom, or some of the other ones, what was his name? Why can't I think of it now? Not Ted Bundy. Jeffrey Dahmer. You know, it's like a tense household. Something that's not necessarily directly abusive, kind of. Those are the ones that I'm kind of drawn to. I do kind of enjoy the bizarre, sexually driven ones and a lot of the ones that I've noticed. I mean, I'd have to say, like, I can't speak for serial killers. You know, mine is just personal interest and, you know, what I enjoy and look up. But I thoroughly enjoy the ones that, for some reason, like, it's some sort of sexual gratification. Especially Albert Fish, like, that, he fascinates me because it's just terrible and weird. But I think those have to be the ones that drive me the most. That's why I think I like H.H. Holmes, because he wasn't driven by that need. An instant gratification. I don't know.
Well,
if
you look at the sexually driven ones, have you looked into Carl Panzeran at all?
Yeah. I've only found him recently, probably within the last 2 years. Oh, man, I probably spent 3 days doing nothing but